thinking it was the fairest of all the overtly anti-union press. The ILWU was headed by Harry Bridges, the radical Australian immigrant who had led the violent longshoremen's strike in 1934. The warehousemen were headed by another very strong leader, Eugene Patton, one of a huge and authentic waterfront family, all of whom had grown up there and earned their living on the ships or around the harbor. Patton, or Pat, as he was known everywhere, was a wonderfully romantic figure. Smart, funny, and intuitive, though uneducated in any formal sense, he was a brave leader and a charismatic one. Each of these players said that I could make myself at home in his office and that if there were developments, he would inform me. They all got together at the end of the day to trade information and unwind, usually at a bar at the foot of Sacramento Street, and I began going along. With Cagle, Patton, and occasionally Harry Bridges, I spent many hours up and down the waterfront in one of the 20 or more small dark bars within a 3-block area. We used to get Boilermakers, a glass of beer and a shot of whiskey, at 25 cents each. If you bought two, you got the third one free. Pretty heady stuff for a 21-year-old. We all became great friends. In fact, in a most unprofessional manner, I realize now, Pat and I became more than friends. He was an early romance of mine. We really liked each other. He was not only highly intelligent, but very good-looking. Some weeks after we met, I realized that he was married. I also realized that he had a serious drinking problem. His courage and extraordinary leadership abilities revealed themselves during World War II, when in the Battle of the Bulge he was promoted from a private to an officer after all his officers had been killed, and he took charge. Unfortunately, after the war, he went on with his hard living and drinking, and eventually committed suicide by leaping off the Golden Gate Bridge. I had carefully guarded my identity, and was merely viewed by the labor leaders as the reporter from the news, until my allotted time at the paper was about to expire. Patton had made some reference to future plans, and I said I wasn't sure I'd be there. "Why?" he said. "Are they going to fire you?" "Not exactly," I responded, and then told them I had been hired only for 2 months at the request of my father, who was an Eastern publisher. They wanted to know who he was, of course, and what the paper was. When I told them, they were momentarily surprised and puzzled, but accepted it, and we went on as usual. It was lucky that they knew of my connection to the Post, because later Melnikov, a somewhat humorless and paranoid figure, said to them, "Be careful, we have a spy in our midst." Somehow he had found out that I was the daughter of a capitalist and therefore suspected I was a capitalist spy. Since I had already confessed, my pals were able to laugh and say, "Yes, it's all right, we know who she is." There was no secret on the paper about my new friends, although the extent of our nightly forays was probably not known. I tried to be above board. I told the paper and my family, and felt I maintained objectivity in my reporting. Such behavior wouldn't be tolerated now. I shouldn't have been getting too close personally to one side of a dispute, no matter how useful my new friendships proved to the paper. Things on the waterfront eventually came to an impasse and went into mediation, at which point the coverage scene changed to long waits outside the mediation room door, with half a dozen of us sitting around for hours whenever we thought there might be a break. One day the principals were getting seated while the reporters were still inside the room. The night before had been the opening of the opera, one of the biggest social events of the year in San Francisco, for which everyone dressed absurdly elaborately. I had been invited by my aunt and had sent east for my best dress from the previous year. It was long black velvet with leopard-skin shoulder straps forming a V in front and a lower one in the back. A photograph showing a large expanse of my back had appeared amidst the massive coverage of this event. Suddenly, to my consternation, Sam Cagle looked up and said to Bridges across the table, "Well, Harry, black velvet and leopard skin, what do you think of that?" Amidst peals of laughter from the table, I vanished. After the lockout was over, I was assigned almost full-time to an even more important dispute from the point of view of the newspapers, the retail store clerk's strike, which, like all San Francisco labor disputes, was long and violent and damaging to the economic prosperity of the community. By the time my 2 months on the paper were up, I was in the throes of all the excitement and wanted very much to stay on. But this was complicated by economic belt tightening on all the papers due to lineage losses caused by the retail store strike. I wrote a troubled letter to my father asking for his advice on what to do next. He responded quickly by calling my boss, thanking him for the past weeks, and making it easy for him to close the incident. Happily, my boss said he wanted me to stay, that I was doing fine work, that they would be delighted to keep me permanently, and that my father had a right to feel proud of me. Dad said that from that point on, I was there on my own, and I decided to stay until I thought the point of diminishing returns had been reached. My social life in San Francisco was a curious but happy mix of my friends from work and the waterfront, and the people I met through the family and a few old connections, each set of friends perfectly aware of the other. Through Aunt Ro, who, with her wide range of artistic and civic interests, had become a leader of the San Francisco community, I met Maurice Stern, a fine artist, and his wife Vera, and through them, the Mexican artist Covarrubias, who is in San Francisco to do his murals for the upcoming exposition. I went to the theater to see Gertrude Lawrence and Susan and God, and then met her at a party given in her honor by Albert Bender, an elderly art collector and bachelor friend of my aunt's, who became a friend of mine as well. It was Albert who gave Ansel Adams his first camera, and Adams, the great photographer of Western scenery, and his wife Virginia were two other good friends out there. With Bill Hewitt, who ended up as the CEO of the John Deere Company, I went to Yosemite Valley to spend New Year's Eve with the Adamses, who were running a photography store there. The Adamses had only their guest bedroom, where I slept. Bill, amazingly handsome and tall, slept on a cot in the front display window of the studio, where they had hung curtains to shield their sleeping guest from passers-by. I had also become close to Jane Nalen, the most glamorous, interesting young woman friend I had ever had. Jane, the daughter of Hearst's lawyer and close associate John Francis Nalen, was far more worldly than anyone I had known, and I was more serious and work-oriented than most of her circle. We became friends almost instantly, and have remained friends all our lives. I also saw a good deal of my friend from Madeira, Jean Rawlings. Many Sundays, Aunt Ro and I went to Stern Grove for concerts and picnics. Aunt Rosalie had given the city this hillside grove of eucalyptus trees, which formed a natural amphitheater in which a concert stage was built and where she funded free Sunday afternoon concerts. There were jars discreetly placed around the grove for donations if you felt so inclined, and Aunt Ro used to stay after the concerts and count the contributions, which were a tangible measure of public appreciation. In a funny way, I kept in touch with the world outside San Francisco through my parents. My father asked me to send him all my stories, even the most inconsequential ones, and urged me to keep writing him letters as another way of learning to write. It was also my father who kept me up on both domestic and international politics. He was especially worried about the growing anti-Semitism in Germany. One of his ways of helping to deal with the horror was to support a great friend of his, the psychiatrist Marion Kenworthy, with a legislative scheme to permit the adoption of 20,000 refugee children. What was more important for my personal future than his review of the domestic and international scene was my father's appraisal of what was happening at the Post. Although all the papers in Washington were down in lineage, the Times and the Herald were suffering the most, and the Post the least. Still, the Star had more than double our share of the advertising field. Dad was optimistic about circulation growth, as well he might have been, with the Post making significant gains after a rather stationary period. We were at 117,000, and hoping to reach 125,000 before the rise abated. Although I rarely had time to read the whole paper, the Post did look better to me all the time. My father's worries about the Post no doubt escalated in February 1939, when Sissy Patterson created one big all-day paper by combining the Afternoon Times with the Morning Herald, though first she had to settle a costly strike threat precipitated by all the people she was firing. Mother reported to me that Sissy was ill in bed and said, "I don't think she will last much longer," a comment that I wasn't sure referred to Sissy herself or reflected Mother's wishful thinking about Sissy's newspaper. Mother's life went on in its usual fashion. Her latest spiritual conquest was DeWitt Wallace, owner of the Reader's Digest, and her next-door neighbor in Mount Kisco. She had met Anthony Eden and described him as a slender reed for democracy to lean on. In fact, she was struck by the lack of virility on the part of a number of the world's supposed leaders and concluded that if democracy was going to be saved, the United States would have to save it. She, like my father, was working hard to help get Jewish children to Palestine, or at least out of Europe. She was busy lecturing to women's clubs and actively speaking out against fascism. Meanwhile, Thomas Mann remained the focus of much of Mother's energy throughout the late 1930s and early 1940s. Mann awed her, but she felt she surprised him a little, too. Somebody once asked him if my mother was German, to which he replied, "Oh yes, very. She is a Valkyrian type with something else, a mixture of Valkyrie and Juno." She was so pleased with this description that she thought it ought to be put in writing for her grandchildren, so here it is. The Mons often visited my parents in Washington and Mount Kisco. I met him on one of the early visits in 1938 and was disappointed, for I thought him cold, unfeeling, and hard to talk to. But Mother worshipped him. She wrote me, "He is the biggest thing I ever met, bar nothing." Though my father lived fairly amicably and generally uncomplainingly with most of my mother's male friends, he got rather tired of being left with Mann's wife while the two spouses went off into intellectual discussions, most often conducted in German. She adored Mann openly, but he returned her adoration diffidently. Nonetheless, she still had the feeling I am one of the few people and one of the very few women he has ever liked. In truth, the real passion seemed to be on her side only. Mann has been described by one of his biographers, Donald Prater, as a cold nature, with a complete lack of interest and of real feeling for others. According to Prater, Mann tended to exploit people for his personal convenience. He may well have cold-bloodedly maintained the relationship because knowing Mother and taking advantage of her resources proved of great help to him. Indeed, Mother came to his rescue time and again. Over the years of their friendship, she did an immense number of favors for Mann and his family. She tried to make him more understandable to the American public by translating some of his essays and writing long reviews of his books, many of which appeared in the Post. In one letter to her, he referred to the plethora of honors showered on him in the United States, but said, in essence, that what he really needed was financial sustenance. Mother's immediate response was, "If my intellectual efforts are at your disposal, why not then every material resource I possess?" She swung immediately into action. Having already helped smooth the way for an academic berth for him at Princeton, a position that entailed little work and gave him time to write, she now got the Library of Congress, on whose board she served, to make him consultant in Germanic literature with a yearly stipend of $4,800. There were endless other courtesies, including help in acquiring passports for some of his children. Prater describes my mother as wanting to become too much a part of Mann's life, and therefore becoming a burden and an irritant to him. Mann wrote at one point that he felt an almost uncontrollable desire to give this woman tyrannizing me a piece of my mind, which is just what he seems to have done in a frank letter he wrote her later, saying that he had served their friendship faithfully and with care. "Serving is the very word. For years I have devoted to it more thought, nervous energy, work at the desk, than to any other relationship in the world. I have let you participate as well as I know how in my inner and outer life. On your visits I have read aloud to you for hours from new work no one else has seen. I have shown the most sincere admiration for your patriotic and social activities. But nothing was right, nothing enough. You always wanted me different from the way I am. You did not have the humor or the respect or the discretion to take me as I am. You wanted to educate, dominate, improve, redeem me." Theirs, like all of her relationships, was clearly a complicated one. Three themes dominated my own letters: the anguish of the impending war in Europe, my work, and my play. No matter how immersed I was in the latter two, It was hard to forget that so much hinged on events in Europe, even though Europe seemed much more remote from California than it had from the East Coast. I listened one morning to a speech by Hitler and wrote afterwards that the broadcast sounded a little bit as though you had gotten the zoo by mistake, that rasping voice punctuated by roars that sounded like a pack of insane animals. The more serious the situation abroad became, the more I thought it important to work terribly hard to learn the game well. Not that I thought I or any individual could make a difference, but I thought I'd go mad if I wasn't doing as much as I could in my own little rut. As the labor story wound down, I looked forward to writing again. The routine activities involved in being a legman and getting kicked around were lots of fun after the highly theoretical existence I'd been leading in Chicago, but I was ready to start becoming a reporter. Initially, I covered sob sister stuff, a little girl whose Christmas tree had burned and to whom the news sent presents, a suicide off the Golden Gate Bridge, an interview with a woman who, in a fit of despondency because her husband didn't love her anymore, tried to choke her baby. The news from Europe was crowded out of the San Francisco papers by a first-class sex murder with a beautiful blonde corpse. One brush with crime reporting came when I was sent out with a photographer to cover a distinctly unglamorous incident. A garbage truck emptying its contents at the city dump had turned up a corpse, a man who had been dead at least a week. My prayers were answered when the undertaker arrived just before we did, made off with a corpse, and saved me from the grisly spectacle. Not my story, but that of another reporter, was the discovery of a lady brutally murdered, her breasts cut off. Across her torso, with her lipstick, had been written, "Honey, I love you." My mother sympathized with my assignments, deploring the way ugly things rest in the mind. In her inimitable fashion, she suggested I apply Schopenhauer's rule of objectivity. Unhinge the will until you feel neither hate nor fear. My progress at work was uneven, a series of ups and downs. Every once in a while, I thought I was catching on to the art of writing a news story, yet even when I felt I might be getting the hang of it in terms of speed and efficiency, the top still seemed so terribly far away. Efficiency was my special bugaboo. Every time I did something stupid, I could hear my French governess's voice resounding through the years, saying, "Étourdi, veux-tu mettre les accents? Scatterbrain, will you put on the accents?" Here I was, years later, still forgetting to put the accents on. I feared getting scooped, but so far it hadn't happened. I went on worrying that I might be hanging on, that I mightn't have been kept on if it hadn't been for my name. But then, thinking back to my first day, I remembered the hour it had taken me to write a 3-line item and felt encouraged by having in just one day written 2 half-column stories, covered a wool growers' convention and a fire, and written the weekly church column that always got foisted on some poor sucker. The news, chronically short of staff, was particularly so while I was there, and I was always tired by evening when I rode home on the cable car. My final story for the paper was the opening of the Golden Gate International Exposition on San Francisco's Treasure Island, celebrating the new Golden Gate Bridge and the Oakland Bay Bridge. I covered the exposition all day and went out at night with an architect friend, Bill Worster, who had designed the arts building for it. In the spring of 1939, my father came out to visit and reminded me that I had said I was going to come back to work on the Post. In fact, his visit came at a propitious moment. The news was going through yet another of its economy drives, and it seemed clear that someone would be let go, in which case I, the junior person, was the likely candidate. Besides, I was worried about taking someone's job who needed it. So I agreed with my father that I would return to Washington, not exactly reluctantly, but not without mixed feelings and a certain sense of loss. I loved those months I spent in San Francisco as I have loved few times in my life. On April 24, 1939, my photo appeared in Time magazine on the personalities page with the brief story, "To Washington, D.C., went comely 21-year-old Catherine Meyer, daughter of publisher Eugene Meyer, to handle for $25 a week the letters to the editor department of her father's Post. said Father Meyer. If it doesn't work, we'll get rid of her. Some of my San Francisco friends, with Cagle in the lead, sent me the clip with a note. There are no ifs in California. Come back to us. Chapter 7. Coming back to Washington after nearly 5 years away, at college and in San Francisco, I found a new city. I had no idea how much Washington had changed since I'd left for Vassar. There was an intellectually exciting atmosphere, a sea change from the Washington I had left behind in 1934. I was happily surprised, indeed thrilled, by this new city, alive with energetic, dynamic young people. From the stodgy town I'd known, where a small group of older people were the establishment and saw each other constantly at very formal dinners, and the young people were set in a different but equally boring routine, there had sprung a young person's ideal place. There have been two periods in my lifetime when the excitement of government and of public issues drew to Washington many of the bright young people graduating from colleges and law schools. These were essentially the Roosevelt and the Kennedy years. In the time I'd been mostly gone, large numbers of these able, idealistic young men and women had come to town ready to help institute reforms, to get the economy working again, to guarantee certain benefits to those without jobs, or social security to those in retirement, or minimum wages to those with low-paying jobs. It was a moment when youth could accomplish a lot, when ideas percolated up and were listened to by those in authority. Against this backdrop, in April of 1939, I went to work on the Post. I felt it unwise to try to be a reporter back in Washington, since it would be awkward being the publisher's daughter, so it was agreed that I would become an editorial page employee, work that was very different from what I had been doing in San Francisco. I now worked for the editorial page editor, Felix Morley. The editorial team, with me quite the junior member, met every morning to discuss the issues of the day. Assignments were made based on an individual's particular expertise, Morley saving the biggest domestic and international issues for himself. By 1939, the president's energies were concentrated on uniting the country on events abroad. This meant abandoning most of the New Deal programs except for those already in place. So the Post's editorials and news began to be more in sync with the administration. The paper fiercely backed preparedness in this country. As early as April 1939, when Roosevelt casually said as he was leaving Warm Springs, Georgia, "I'll be back in the fall if we don't have a war," the Post's editorial page led with, "In using the collective we, the president told Hitler and Mussolini that the tremendous force of the United States must be a factor in their current thinking." Roosevelt told reporters that this so represented his thinking, he had almost fallen out of bed when he read it. On September 1, 1939, the day the German army invaded Poland, Barnett Barney Nover, one of my editorial colleagues, and I went together to President Roosevelt's press conference in the Oval Office. The fact that he could take me, an unaccredited journalist, to the White House now seems amazing. At that time, the president's press conferences generally consisted of a small group of mostly men standing around the president's desk, listening to him talk, bantering, and asking a few questions. On this day, it was a larger and more solemn group. Barney and I were there early, and so were fairly close to the president's desk. In his diary, Barney noted the tone of the meeting. There was a tense feeling of sobriety and solemnity at the conference. The president made a very good impression. When we left, Kate said she couldn't help being impressed by him, and I said that whatever his faults, Roosevelt was superb in an emergency. By this time, the strain between Morley's view that we must stay out of the war and my father's opposite view that we had to help the Allies and, if necessary, get in, reached a climax. Morley resigned the following spring, and it was announced in August that he would become president of Haverford College. My friends and I were all exultant that the rift had finally caused Morley to depart, so committed were we all to helping the Allies. Being young, we couldn't understand why it had taken my father so long to see the light. The transition, however, was fairly smooth. My father first tried to hire Elmer Davis, a popular news radio broadcaster, but in the end he settled for a recommendation of Morley's, Herbert Elliston, financial editor for the Christian Science Monitor. As Morley had done, Elliston carried the page to greater and greater strength. In my first year or so at the Post, I began to write with some frequency on the least important issues, so-called light editorials. The titles themselves are revealing of just how light. On Being a Horse, Brains and Beauty, Mixed Drinks, Lou Gehrig, and Spotted Fever. I wrote about folk songs inspiring American soldiers, about women mobilizing for defense work, and defended Archibald MacLeish, Librarian of Congress, from accusations of being a fellow traveler. I wrote a book review of a book by Klaus and Erica Mann, Escape to Life, and was unmercifully teased by my friends for the bromidic opening phrase, "It is no easy task Klaus and Erica Mann have set themselves." I also edited the letters to the editor, made up parts of the page, which involved numerous trips to the composing room on the floor below our offices, where printers put the hot lead rows of type into page forms on dollies as I watched. One of us proofread the page each night, as well as the opinion page, which contained syndicated columns, along with some contributed by Post reporters and editors. I took my turn at this. Around the time of the changeover from Morley to Elliston, I moved over to the Brains section, Today's Outlook, and worked for a year there. I soon began to meet many of the Post's reporters and to deepen my friendship with others. We occasionally left our dingy, run-down but picturesque building to lunch at Child's or other little neighborhood restaurants on E Street. I quickly fell in with two young reporters whom I hadn't previously known, John Oakes, nephew of Arthur Sulzberger, then the publisher of the New York Times, and Hedley Donovan, a young, bright Minnesotan, handsome, soft-spoken, and very funny. He had been a Rhodes Scholar, then returned from England and got a job with the Post. John, also a Rhodes Scholar, later became editorial page editor of the New York Times, and Hedley became editor-in-chief of Time, Inc. Because of my friendship with Post reporters like John and Hedley, my work world spilled over into a social life that grew lively and rich in very short order. There were legions of young men in Washington who grouped together to live in houses, which proved to be cheap, attractive, and advantageous to all those rooming cooperatively. Most of these men were on modest government salaries, but by pooling their resources, they lived like kings. Hedley lived at one of these bachelor houses, located on S Street near Connecticut Avenue, where I went to a party one night in the fall of 1939. We all went to a nearby restaurant for dinner, and a few of us got back to S Street before our fellow diners. I was looking out the window, calling to the others, when the screen fell out right onto the heads of those returning, one of whom was Philip Graham, whom I met for the first time that night when he looked up to see me staring down with my mouth agape. Later that same evening, I went to a bathroom upstairs and there ran into a girl named Phyllis Asher, who said she was going to law school, which at that time was very unusual for a woman. I exclaimed with admiration, saying that I couldn't possibly do it, and asking how she managed the difficult work. "Well," she replied, "it's made easier because I'm engaged to Phil Graham." She said Phil would come by for her at night, and over a milkshake they would discuss anything that was on her mind, and this helped. "Oh, how wonderful," I replied, thinking only that he was the one I had just nearly maimed by dropping a screen on his head. When the S Street house became too crowded, a second house was found, into which some of the S Street residents moved, together with some others. This second house was in Arlington, 5 minutes away from the Virginia end of Key Bridge. It was essentially those with automobiles who moved to this house. Hockley, as the house was called, belonged to Admiral and Mrs. Theodore Wilkinson, whose daughters were friends of the boys. When Admiral Wilkinson left Washington for the duration of the war, the Wilkinsons bravely rented the house for very little money to 12 young men. John Oakes and Deering Danielson, a wealthy young man who worked in the State Department and whose family owned the Atlantic Monthly, were the only non-lawyers among the Hockley boys. The lawyers included Graham Clater, who had been Louis Brandeis's law clerk, Adrian Fisher, known as Butch, a Tennessean who had clerked for both Brandeis and Felix Frankfurter, gentle, sweet Bill Sheldon, who was the most beloved by us all, Quinn Shaughnessy, who became a friend of mine that fall, Edwin McIlwain, one of Chief Justice Hughes's two law clerks, the star Edward Pritchard, known to all as Pritch, Felix Frankfurter's law clerk that year, a brilliant, talented, funny, fat, witty storyteller and mimic, as well as a marvelous conversationalist, and Pritch's great friend, Phil Graham, then clerking for Supreme Court Justice Stanley Reed while waiting to clerk for Frankfurter the following year. Two of these boys, Graham Clater and Phil Graham, together with Ed Huddleston, who had stayed behind at the S Street House, had successively been editors of the Harvard Law Review, then the most prestigious collegiate job in the country, closely rivaled only by the editorships of the Yale and Columbia Law Reviews. Hockley itself had probably been built at the turn of the century. It was made of red brick and had four white pillars on a veranda overlooking a lawn that rolled down toward the nearby Potomac River. The house commanded a magnificent view of the river and the city just across it. It was like a second-hand Tara from Gone with the Wind. There was a huge living room and a dining room that could seat about 20 people that was almost always full. There was also a library on the ground floor, and there were at least 6 bedrooms upstairs. Because they pooled their resources, and the rent was low to begin with, the boys almost certainly would never again live so well for so little. They had a gardener and a full-time cook and a maid. And most important, they had Johnson, the all-American equivalent of a major domo. Johnson and his wife had worked for Dean and Alice Acheson for at least 25 years, until the day Alice discovered they had never actually gotten married and sent them packing, much to Dean's dismay. This happened just when Hockley was being rented, and the boys were able to snag Johnson, who ran this new chaotic household with aplomb. Life, for me, fell into a glorious pattern, largely centered on Hockley. An extraordinary assembly of guests gathered there, including Dean Acheson, Archibald MacLeish, Felix Frankfurter, Ben Cohen, Francis Biddle, and various other New Dealers, Harvard professors and judges and justices, sometimes even for breakfast. 4 of us spent so much time there we became known as Hockley's house girls, Alice Barry, Anne Wilkinson, Jane Acheson, and myself. There were many others, but we became natural adjuncts of the house. Sometimes we would all meet at Hockley and move on to my parents' country house, farther out in Virginia, or we'd go en masse to the Edward Burling's log cabin for Sunday brunches. No topic was taboo at Hockley. Everything from FDR and the New Deal to communism, Hitler, the rising tide of Nazism, civil rights, all issues and events were discussed in great debates that often went on for days on end. Graham Clater recalled that in arguments they could manage to get 2 or 3, sometimes even 4 sides to any issue on the table. Insults were hurled as a matter of course. It was understood that the abuse and indignities, even ad hominem attacks, were fair weapons in arguing for your position. But in truth, there were no real feuds or solid dislikes, despite the wide variety of political opinion. John Oakes and Pritch, for example, stood at opposite ends of the scale of social decorum and belief about rules of the political game. John, a journalist, believed in impartiality as the correct approach to an understanding of the issues. He was, of course, accused by the ultra-liberals of seeing both or all sides of everything. Pritch and Phil, in a perverse mood of ultra-liberalism, at one time during that winter defended the Russians for invading Finland, cause for very violent continuing arguments, in the course of which even their liberal housemates abandoned them. Pritch and Phil were indeed very liberal, but they also enjoyed espousing unpopular causes. They had sympathy with the Soviet Union, but in the case of Finland, they were essentially pushing the argument more for the exercise than from belief. They were in no real sense pro-communist. There were also many moments of wild hilarity at Hockley. Among his other skills, Johnson made excellent mint juleps, an art that was exercised plentifully at a party one spring. A properly made julep tastes deceptively mild, but it is more or less straight bourbon, weakened only by mashed ice and mint. If it's a hot day and you toss off several, you're headed for trouble. At this party, a Harvard Law School professor, at that time an older man, by our youthful standards, of 33, was a guest. He was planning to return to Boston that night and asked if someone would give him a ride to the station in time to catch the 10:30 train. We agreed to do just that, but by 8:30 no one could find him. He had disappeared. The professor was known to be one of those who hadn't been adequately warned about the juleps, and it was established that he had innocently downed about 6 of them and had last been seen wandering around the grounds of Hockley calling cheers to everybody. Sometime after he came up missing, screams were heard from the parking lot, and one of the young lady guests came rushing back to the house, distraught. She had gotten into her car, only to find a naked man in the back seat. Everyone hurried to the rescue, to find the professor, 5'6" and 200 pounds, with little muscle, out cold in the back seat without a stitch on. He was revived with a bucket of water. His story was that as time passed, he thought, "Gee, it must be time for me to be getting on the train." So he wandered out to the parking lot, climbed into the back seat of the nearest car, decided he was in his sleeping berth, and promptly undressed and sacked out. Things like that seemed to happen all the time at Hockley. My younger sister, Ruth, was being given a tea at Thanksgiving that year as part of her debut. I was trying to help her manage, because she was still somewhat young for her age and very shy, and suggested inviting all the boys from Hockley and S Street to the tea dance at my parents' house. Biss had turned up for the event, carrying with her the glamorous aura of New York, as well as her own innate spark. She was a star at the party, of course. All the boys thought she was wonderful, particularly Pritch, who was captivated. In fact, he developed a crush on Biss and began rushing to New York to see her. I viewed this development with no small measure of concern. I had considered this wonderful group of young men my turf, and here was Biss stepping onto it, the sister who always left me feeling inadequate and envious. In the crowd at the party, I bumped into Phil Graham, whom I hardly knew, and complained facetiously about all the excitement created by Biss. "I think I'll begin to introduce her as, 'This is my sister Biss, who is 4 years older than I am,'" I said. "Yes," he responded, "and of course you'll add, 'and I'm getting along.'" It was typical Phil repartee, and I thought he was pretty funny. By this time, Phil had parted company with Phyllis Asher, and had moved on to my friend Alice Barry. She was from an old Washington family, brought up to take certain traditional steps in society, have a debut and get married, which she later did to the wealthy Oakley Thorne. In the meantime, there were lots of jokes about Phil and Alice, who had become a twosome, and indeed had simultaneously developed cases of poison ivy. Actually, through Pritch's friendship with Biss, I came to know Pritch better, too. After he stopped chasing my sister in New York, he and I became closer friends, and he even developed a minor and very temporary interest in me. My relationship with him always remained a great privilege, but with sad overtones. Pritch was well known throughout Washington and even beyond. He was widely talked about and written about as a future governor of Kentucky, or even president, so great were his political acumen, understanding of public issues, and sense of people. In the end, he may have had too much charm and talent for his own good. Along with all his assets, he had fatal liabilities. He had no discipline or self-control. He left his work undone, his bills unpaid. His friends, and Phil was one of the closest, even finished his work for him on occasion. One weekend, during the time when Pritch was clerking for Frankfurter and Phil for Reed, Pritch went to see Biss and overstayed his leave. Phil completed his work for him on the court. Pritch accepted endless hospitality, seldom reciprocating. When he did take friends to a restaurant, he often found he had forgotten his wallet and someone else had to pay the bill. Bill Sheldon once lamented that Pritch's friendship at Princeton, where they were undergraduates together, cost him about $900 a year, a large sum for those days, when few young people had any money. But, added Bill, it was worth it. Even my parents were charmed by Pritch, but ultimately they too became impatient with his constant acceptance of their hospitality without ever writing a thank you note or displaying normal civility. Biss decided to give a New Year's party at my mother's Virginia house. She told me I could invite a few of the Hockley boys, including the flat-faced one, referring to Phil Graham. The party was a great success, with lots of laughter and the usual loud, raucous arguments. At one point I found myself seated on a bench next to Phil, whom I knew probably the least of all the boys, and was startled when he turned to me, looked at my sister Biss, and asked, "Are we for her?" This question was typical of Phil in several respects. It was instant penetration of the human armor. It cut through formalities and reached you directly. It created a sort of charmed circle, enclosing you and him in an intimate association. And it asked a central and real question. Typically, his question elicited a frank answer in which I said everything I felt about Biss, including the ambivalences, the admiration, and the envy, but the bottom line answer was, "Yes, we are for her." Suddenly, with just one question asked and answered, Phil and I knew each other. The last of us to leave the party piled into the remaining car, and I found myself on Phil's lap the whole way to town, getting to know him even better. A couple of weeks later, early in the new year of 1940, I was invited by Pritch to Sunday lunch at the Ritz-Carlton. There were several of us, and after we had lunched as long as we could, someone suggested driving to the scene of the Happy New Year's party, the cabin, and we spent the afternoon there. At the end of the day, everyone except Phil and me had engagements, so he asked if I wanted to have dinner. We went to a little-known restaurant, had a long dinner, talked and laughed a lot, and drank until quite late, when he took me home. I enjoyed it, but I also realized that we had been the only two without dates, and that he had asked me for that reason. So I still felt a reserve. Phil called me once or twice, and carried on in his usual irreverent, breezy way. I found him captivating. By then, Alice Barry and he had gone their separate ways. I've always thought she was too proper to have ever considered Phil seriously, but in the earliest days at Hockley, she asked me if I knew him. When I said no, not really, she said, "You ought to. He's the best here." The second week in February, Phil called me at work late one afternoon, suggesting we have dinner with one of his college roommates, George Smathers, and his wife, Rosemary. I said I couldn't, for several reasons. It was my night to proofread the editorial and op-ed pages, and on top of that I didn't feel well and feared I was getting the flu. In addition, I wasn't dressed for dinner. I looked as rotten as I felt, in a simple brown wool dress, cotton stockings, and loafers, so I was firm in my regret. Phil was equally firm in his insistence. He pointed out that we would eat at Harvey's, a famous old seafood restaurant next door to the Mayflower, where we could buy the early edition of the Post. He would help me proofread the pages, and we could call in the corrections. It didn't matter how I looked, he persisted, and no doubt this dinner would chase away all my symptoms, which in any case were not preventing me from working. So I gave in and joined him after making up the pages, embarrassed and discomfited when I walked in to find George and Rosemary Smathers looking incredibly handsome and impeccably dressed for the occasion. The evening, however, was fine and fun. Phil drove me home, and we talked for a long time. He told me that he loved me, and said we would be married and go to Florida if I could live with only two dresses, because I had to understand that he would never take anything from my father or be involved with him, and we would live on what he made. My breath was taken away. I was, to put it mildly, startled. This was a little ahead of where I was, but not that much ahead. I agreed that it sounded like quite a good idea, but perhaps a bit rash, and that we should put the idea of marriage on hold for all of a month or so while we deliberated and considered. Phil agreed to the month's delay. It all seems so odd in retrospect. A fast month of deliberate hesitation passed, and in reality it hardly occurred. It seemed to be a given to both of us that, although we were trying to be discreet, things were moving forward. In fact, the night of the Smathers dinner, Phil, whistling happily, had returned to the room at Hockley he shared with Pritch. Pritch, already long in bed, turned over, looked at Phil, and in the throes of his momentary crush on me said, "You son of a bitch, you've got her!" Pritch went into a month-long pout, a real anger, during which he once threw his drink at us. He finally emerged as our best man. Despite my hesitation, the fact is I was charmed and dazzled. and I was incredulous. This brilliant, charismatic, fascinating man loved me. Even in my excitement over the sudden and unexpected development, and quite apart from his magnetism, I saw at once that the combination of qualities I had hoped for in any possible man had surprisingly and actually come together in this one. Here was someone who combined for me the two parts of my life that I thought were inescapably separate. For the first time, I had found a man who was that right mix of intellectual, physical, and social charm, and warm and funny on top of that. Phil was bright, issue-oriented, hard-working, witty, and to me, amazingly good-looking, with his leanness and angularity making him much more interesting and appealing to me than classic good looks. He loved me, and I loved him. It was incredibly exciting. The morning after our proclamations of love, my worst flu fears were realized. I had a roaring temperature and was unable to get out of bed. The doctor was called and told me to stay quiet. It was Valentine's Day, and Phil sent a funny bouquet of yellow daffodils and red tulips with a cupid and an arrow, followed by a phone call asking, "Has the vet been there?" Although the vet had ordered solitary confinement, the sender arrived in the late afternoon and sat on my bed for hours as we talked and talked. That month, my mother was away with Biss in Nassau. Phil came and went, either visiting or picking me up often enough to cause my father to be suspicious about us. He and I were traveling to New York, talking about young men and what their current interests were. I told him that the young men I knew were mostly lawyers, many of them doing government work. He asked me who was the most interesting of these, and I naturally began describing Phil, without altogether considering what I was doing. I must have made quite an impression with my characterization, because my father asked, "Are you serious?" The agreed-on month was not over, but I said yes, I thought I was. My father promptly said that in that case he would like to know Phil and asked me to invite him to dinner. I was surprised I had waded into this, but didn't blame my father for his natural curiosity. I called Phil, confessed the conversation, and asked if he minded being looked over. With some trepidation, he agreed. He made no bones about regarding my father as a wealthy ogre who might want to entangle an unsuspecting young son-in-law in his tentacles. He had never before encountered this kind of wealth and power, and was darkly suspicious. I asked two other friends to dinner also, to make things impersonal and less intense. Phil arrived, and one of the first things my father did was to show him an old cartoon by the Post's talented cartoonist, Gene Elderman. It had to do with Justice Hugo Black, who in the course of his confirmation hearings had been revealed as once having been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. There was a figure of Black on the court in Klan robes, with the title Reform of the Judiciary. Phil's response was, "Well, that's a very good drawing and a clever one, but I disagree with its message. I happen to think Justice Black is one of the ablest and hardest-working members of the court, and one of its finest minds." The room was almost enveloped in smoke. My heart sank as the arguments grew louder and longer, continuing most of the evening. When the guests finally left, I said morosely to my father that it seemed to have been an unfortunate occasion. "What do you mean?" my father inquired. "I had a wonderful time and liked him fine." I breathed a sigh of relief and informed Phil that he had passed. My mother returned from her trip a few evenings later and joined the family in time for dinner. She was describing her trip when my father interrupted her to say, "We are having champagne for dinner." "Fine," she replied, and went on talking.
"Don't you want to know why we are having champagne for dinner?" my father persevered.
Without a moment's pause, she looked up and asked excitedly, "Sissy's gone out of business?"
"No," said my father. "Kay's engaged to be married."
"Oh," said my stunned mother. "To whom?" This whole whirlwind romance had essentially occurred while she was gone. Typically, I had told her nothing about Phil. Equally interesting, my father hadn't picked up the phone and called her. She had met Phil only in large crowds of young people and didn't remember him, so we had another look-me-over lunch with my mother, after which I saw Flo in New York. She asked, "Who is this guy you are marrying? Mother says he has a fine jawline."
One important thing didn't happen. There had been a lot of parental disapproval of both my older sister's suitors at various stages. I felt hopeful that my parents would like Phil, but it never occurred to me to be influenced by what they thought, whereas both Flo and Bis had been dissuaded from marrying people they loved. Who was this young man who had so suddenly entered all our lives? Where had he come from? His father, Ernest Graham, was born in Croswell, a small town in northern Michigan. He was the heart of integrity and can-do earthiness, a man with a gruff, appealing quality, hard-working and determined, interested in public issues and politics. And he was shy, hiding his emotions beneath a stern exterior. Phil's mother, Florence Morris, was born in Lincoln, Nebraska, and had been a schoolteacher in South Dakota, despite not being a college graduate. Floss, as she was called, was by all accounts an extraordinarily charming, strong, intelligent, and sensitive partner who stood up to Ernie, even at the cost of angry rows that ensued when she did so. These affected Phil strongly. He couldn't bear anger or arguments or confrontations. His father had once, he told me, thrown a lamp at his mother in the course of a battle. In one of the first quarrels we ever had, during which I slammed a door, he said he couldn't deal with that kind of scene because of ones he had witnessed as a child and pleaded that we never fight like that. So I didn't. This wasn't a good idea and led to many unresolved issues. Having a no-fight rule meant that I didn't bring up things that disturbed me, and neither did Phil. An unhealthy situation in which things that upset one or the other of us didn't get aired. Floss was loved and admired by all who knew her. She made friends, always reaching out to the world, even in the impoverished and almost pioneering circumstances in which the Grahams lived during the depths of the Depression in Florida. It was very much to his mother that Phil related, and to whom he felt most close. Phil was in some ways a mother's boy. He was nurtured and enriched by Floss. She was the cultured one, the reader, as well as the social-friendly one. Phil was born in 1915 in Terry, South Dakota, where his father was then working as a gold mining engineer. He was the second child born to Ernie and Floss, 2 years after his sister Mary. The Grahams lived in a house on the side of a mountain in the Black Hills until Ernie went into the army in 1917. The war had caused the price of gold to drop until the mine was no longer profitable to operate. So when Ernie got out of the army, he returned to Croswell and operated a couple of dairy farms there for 2 years. Through a friend, Ernie heard about an attempt by the Pennsylvania Sugar Company to grow sugarcane in the Everglades. George Earl Sr., the company's owner, had gone to Florida after the war and bought several hundred thousand acres of land in or around the Everglades, from outside Miami to Lake Okeechobee, envisioning draining the swamps and ending up with rich, usable soil. He wanted his company, Pennsuco, to grow sugarcane on it for its refinery in Philadelphia. The Florida project was costing a lot and producing nothing. This friend of the Grahams, who was the general manager of Pennsuco, wanted someone with an agricultural and engineering background to come down and look it over, and he asked Ernie to take the job. Ernie went to Florida and was asked to stay on the plantation as the resident manager. So in 1921, the Graham family moved to the Everglades, about 50 miles outside Miami. The area was still a wilderness, with no houses and only a few shacks. The only other inhabitants were Seminole Indians. The Grahams built houseboats on a couple of barges moored to the sides of one of the main canals that laced the Everglades. They lived on one and used the other as a guest house, and there they stayed until 1924, when Phil's brother Bill was born. Bill was actually born on the houseboat, but Floss had said that if she was going to have a baby, she needed a house. So about 6 months later, the family moved to a solidly built rock farmhouse. Phil's memories of his early childhood were romantic. He described alligators sunning themselves on the ropes that anchored the houseboat, and portrayed himself and his friends as jumping overboard to swim in the canal. His best friend was Charlie Tigertail, a Seminole Indian whose brother was killed by a white man. The Indians would often take Mary and Phil in their dugout canoes up and down the canal. Charlie and other Seminoles taught Phil to hunt and fish, two passions that remained with him throughout his life. Years later, At our farm in Virginia, he would go fishing late and early, and sometimes even all night. He had quail patches and bird dogs, and relentlessly pursued groundhogs with rifles that had telescopic sights. There in the Everglades, the Grahams hung on and eventually triumphed over the wilderness, the hurricanes that then regularly swept through, and the 1929 crash. First, however, it was discovered that the experiment with the sugarcane was not working. After a hurricane struck in 1926 and flooded the entire area, the company gave up on sugar and, under the name Pennsuco Farming Company, took up large-scale truck farming, investing millions of dollars over the next few years, before Mr. Earle got discouraged and retreated completely, leaving Ernie with some of the land as a sort of severance. Ernie looked around for a way to earn his living and decided to develop the small dairy that had been set up on the place to serve the Pennsuco employees. By early 1932, the Grahams were delivering 2 loads of milk a day to a friend with a small chain of grocery stores. Ernie had made a deal to supply milk for 2 cents a quart under the home delivery price. From that, he began to build some roots, and the dairy grew. His trucks went into Miami every day to buy and bring back blocks of ice, and Phil was taken to school by the ice trucks. If the ice house moved, Phil moved too, to a school nearby. Because of his precocity, he had started school in the 3rd grade in Hialeah. When the teacher found out he couldn't read and was going to put him back a grade, his mother taught him to read so quickly he was able to stay on. Phil was always the youngest and smallest in his class, and therefore socially behind the others. Mrs. Graham worried about his friends when he was young. One was the son of a wealthy Cadillac dealer and had too much money, while another was the son of a decoy, a lady who sat on the back of a rum runner, knitting, to make it look like a pleasure boat or yacht. Mainly, the Grahams were poor and had a difficult struggle. The Depression had hit Florida particularly hard. At Christmas, Phil's mother saw that every child in the area got at least 1 present. She would go to a local store and spend a dime for each present. These gifts were all that many of those children had. Phil recalled that it was a good week when his family saved a quarter for the Saturday night movie. His brother Bill remembers that the common wages they paid were 20 cents an hour for a 10-hour day. Until World War II, we worked a 7-day week in the dairy, no days off and no vacations. We'd feed the cows early on Sunday, so we'd get off early Sunday afternoon. Eventually, the farm employed about 50 young single men, but even with the low wages and endless work, there were all kinds of people working there, including 1 Rhodes Scholar and several other college graduates. With the farm operating fairly successfully, Ernie got involved in politics and spent years in public life, first on the State Road Board, later as state senator, years in which he campaigned for taxing the racetracks and using the funds to subsidize aid for older citizens. He wound up running for governor in 1943-44, suffering a narrow defeat. No one had ever been elected to state office from Dade County, which includes Miami, and was unpopular with the rest of the rural state. Ernie almost beat the odds. From school in Hialeah, Phil went on to high school in Miami. Years later, he told me he had developed his wit and humor as a way to deal with his younger boy's social and athletic disadvantages and compete with boys in his class who were older and more sophisticated. His high school yearbook notes his selection as the wittiest in the class. Toward the end of his life, he acknowledged to me that he used humor as a weapon with which to keep people at a distance. Phil went from Miami High School to the University of Florida, where the boys with whom he roomed were athletes and politicians, including George Smathers, who later became a U.S. senator. In college, Phil enjoyed fraternity life and girls, and he drank a good deal of bathtub gin before Prohibition was repealed. He ran Graham's Dairy in the summers, when his family went on vacations to Michigan, which Ernie still thought of as home. In 1934, when Phil was 19, his mother died of cancer, one of the great tragedies of his life. He was devastated. He had loved her deeply and was dependent on her love of him. He was so reluctant to talk about her that it was years before I realized this. He later confessed that he had cried himself to sleep night after night in college after she died.
Phil was kept out of school to work on the farm the year his mother was dying, and this year driving milk trucks, plus the summers running the farm, undoubtedly taught him how to get along with all kinds of people, those who worked for him and with him, as well as the customers whom he had to please. He was also influenced by the battles that resulted from the differences between him, with his pleasure-loving gaiety and tendency to drink, and his hard-driving teetotaler father. Another great influence on Phil was an older man, a friend of his parents, one of several mentors in Phil's life. W.I. Evans was a lawyer who was also involved in politics, and during her final illness, Phil's mother had discussed with Mr. Evans, who was also the Grahams' lawyer, her desire that Phil go to law school. In response to Floss's question about the best law school, he said it was Harvard, so her dying wish, expressed to Phil, and, more important, to Ernie, was that Phil go there. When the time came, his father said he couldn't afford to send Phil to any law school, but at the last minute he changed his mind. Since it was so late in the school year, Phil tried for the University of Michigan Law School, which turned him down. His father then turned to Claude Pepper, already in Florida politics and a graduate of Harvard Law, and Pepper succeeded in getting Phil admitted. It was easier in those days, when Harvard had a simple method of winnowing out its students. It took one-third more than it had room for, and dropped the lowest third around Thanksgiving. In fact, when the new first-year students arrived, the faculty and administrators said to the freshman class assembled, "Look to the right of you and look to the left of you, because by Thanksgiving one of you won't be here." A young man named Philip Norton, later a friend of Phil's, said he turned to the left of him and saw this young guy in a badly cut country suit looking as though he had straw hanging out of his rather large ears, and decided that Phil was the one who wouldn't be there. Harvard Law School was a unique institution at that time. The boys there, and they were all boys then, with one or two exceptions, were either the brightest brains from the Ivy League or the brightest from CCNY, the New York City public college that had graduated Felix Frankfurter. Phil fell into neither category, but his unusual qualities and brains continued to serve him well. He always had an astonishing memory, an ability to read quickly and remember what he'd read, and he used all that to good advantage. Phil never changed his basic ways. He went on hanging out at the races and in bars. Even so, he did well and thrived in the new environment. At the end of the first year, he was afraid that the all-important final exams had done him in. He told his father he had let him down after his sacrifice in sending him to law school. He thought he might have flunked. When his marks arrived, his father said, "I guess you didn't flunk. It says here you were third in your class." From that position, Phil made the law review, and at the end of his second year, became its president. This was undoubtedly one of those crucial events that make all the difference in a person's life. It brought him a new intellectual stimulus. It taught him a lot. It raised his profile from fairly invisible to very visible. And it introduced him to Felix Frankfurter, one of the great influences on his life. Two young men were ahead of Phil as potential presidents of the review. Their rivalry succeeded in defeating both of them and creating a deadlock. So in the small hours of the morning, the editors turned to Phil, who was relatively unknown and belonged neither to the Grinds nor to the Ivy League elite. Pritch later said they went and hauled Phil out of a bar and made him president of the Law Review. Soon after this, Ed Huddleston, the previous year's president, told Phil he had to meet Felix. As they were leaving for the meeting, Phil was puzzled to see Huddleston racing through the pages of the New York Times and asked what he was doing. Ed said he was preparing himself to reply to all the questions the little so-and-so will want to discuss. So much of Phil's life flowed from the year as president of the Law Review and from his relationship with Felix Frankfurter. Felix adopted Phil as one of his boys before he was appointed by President Roosevelt to the Supreme Court in January 1939, the middle of Phil's last year in law school. It was with Felix, and with new friends from the Review, that Phil entered the world of great minds, ideas, and books, stimulating conversation, and above all, an interest in current events. Phil had always loved politics, and had spent years campaigning with his father, so he had developed an interest in public issues. But now he'd met a man obsessed with the national and international scene, with the uses of power and ideas, with people and politics and political theory. Chapter 8. The spring of 1940 was spent in a haze of excitement and romance. It was a wonderful time for both of us, but it was also quite crazy to think about getting married so quickly. I suppose I had the usual nervousness about marriage. Phil and I knew each other relatively little, and we were both very young, not quite 23 and 25. We came from such different backgrounds, but had so much in common. Humor, friends, interests, enthusiasms, and political views. There was a great deal going for us, even though the complexities were not understood or addressed, really, ever. Since Phil was going to be Justice Frankfurter's law clerk the following Supreme Court term, he drove the justice home from the court one night and told him of our decision to be married, and even asked his permission, for there had been an unwritten rule that the law clerks remain single so as to be at the complete service of the justice day or night. By this time that tradition had broken down, but Phil still felt the need to ask. Phil later told his father about Felix's reaction, saying that Frankfurter was in fact the only one who could effectively disapprove, so I talked to him first, and instead of disapproving, he was, since he, unlike you, knows the gal, heartily in favor. Indeed, Felix had been a friend of my family's, and therefore had known me, for years. According to Phil, Felix reminded him that the apple never falls very far from the tree. Telling his own father about the upcoming marriage proved to be more difficult than telling Felix or my father, and more painful. Phil wrote to his father on March 17, 1940, inadvertently and in his nervousness dating the letter 1939 and misspelling my name. This should be a very interesting letter for you to read. When the court's work is over, May 27th or soon thereafter, I am going to get married. I know you'll be in favor. Her name is Catherine Meyer, and I've not a doubt in the world that you'll love her. You probably have heard of her father, Eugene Meyer, who is now publisher of the Washington Post, and has been in the past such things as head of the Federal Reserve. He is a Jew, a Republican, and rich as hell. For the last two factors, I am not especially fond of him. The first seems immaterial to me, but I pass it on to you. Her mother happens to be a Gentile. She was one of the first newspaper women in this country, is credited with being quite brilliant, and I find her rather unattractive. Before we get around to discussing Kay, Catherine, this is about enough to mention about the family, except possibly to reemphasize the terrible fact that they are lousy rich. For instance, they live in an absurdly huge, vulgar castle here, have another in New York, have a ranch in Wyoming, etc. Now we shall get around to Kay. She really is about as wonderful a person as you'll ever hope to see. Of course, I can't write you why this is so, but I'll just jot down a few very factual things about her. Then, when we drop in on you this summer, you'll begin to catch on to what I meant. We've known each other since last fall, and finally decided the hell with it all we were going to shove off this summer. As I said before, I can't write you why, yet I've no doubt you'll understand. Naturally, there were a few problems, but I think we've dealt with most of them. In the first place, I thought there might be a problem about Florida. I, of course, want to go back, and though you may not understand this, there are lots of girls who have been raised around here who wouldn't consider this. In any event, this turned out to be very little of a problem, for she is quite willing to test Florida's willingness to feed me. Next, and a little tougher, is the problem of her dough, and I think we've got that worked out. It happens that she has a pretty horrible hunk of it in her name, and we have worked out this solution. We'll live in the sort of house, have the sort of furniture, eat the sort of food, go to the sort of places that young people making salaries like mine can afford. If she wants to spend some of hers on special clothes or special trips, etc., for herself, she will do so, but none of it will go for the sort of joint expenses that ordinary young husbands pay. Mainly, we hope, she'll use her gold by way of helping things and projects she believes in. About the only problems we could possibly have besides these are F.F., you, and her family. F.F. we have already taken care of. I hope this will line you up on our side,
and we don't expect any trouble from her family that we can't handle. This, I think, just about winds up all I can write about Kay and why we're, come what may, going to get married this summer. Ernie upset Phil at first by resisting the idea of his marrying me. There was some talk of my being Jewish, and Ernie mentioned having seen a man on Miami Beach one day who wished he wasn't Jewish. Phil was protectively indignant. The other issue that concerned Ernie was my family's wealth. Whether there were letters between the one Phil wrote and the one his father wrote